Alrighty, welcome to the first kind of interview style podcast of 2023 for the Detection Challenging Paradigms. If you've been following us on Twitter, whether that's the DCP, the podcast account, whether that's me, Jared C. Atkinson, or Johnny J Security 101, or Luke Versace with some leet speak built into there, you may have noticed that we've expanded kind of the operation of the podcast. We found that it's been quite difficult to kind of maintain a consistent schedule when we're inviting guests because maybe their time frame doesn't work out with us, or you know, trying to get all that kind of worked out. So what we're trying to do to maintain some consistency is we've kind of introduced a new subversion of the podcast, which is going to be a live stream, and it's called DCP Live. And the goal of that is to host it every other Monday at 7:30 p.m. Pacific, and it will also be available on demand for those of you. Like, we got some feedback from Olaf Hartung in the Netherlands saying, hey, I'm not going to stay up till 4 a.m. to watch your thing, even though I love you. And so, you know, it is what it is, but it's going to be recorded. So that's cool. Now, as part of that effort, one of the things that we're trying to do is kind of expand our presence on numerous platforms, because we want to live stream on as many platforms as, well, maybe not as many, but quite a few different platforms. So the main platform will be YouTube. So if you're interested in kind of following along, feel free to subscribe to us there. And that would be helpful. Additionally, we'll also be trying to push to Twitter, because that's just kind of where the conversation in InfoSec seems to be happening, but also we'll be pushing to LinkedIn. So one of the goals of DCP Live, so in the interview kind of segment, a lot of times we're talking about really deep dive topics or really nuanced topics, and we kind of have a high expectation of experience for the audience. But in the DCP Live, what we're really going to be going for is trying to explain and work through the fundamental skill sets of detection engineering, at least to begin with. And we think that that's going to be useful for the type of audience that's most likely to be on LinkedIn, people that are searching for jobs, people that are just getting into the industry. That's going to be really useful. The problem is right now we only have 104 followers on LinkedIn on our kind of podcast page. Go ahead and share that, Luke. And according to Luke, we need 150 before we're allowed to live stream to LinkedIn. So if you would be so gracious and go check out the Detection Challenging Paradigms podcast page, you could either find that through search, I suspect, or directly off of mine, Johnny's, or Luke's LinkedIn pages, and then give us a follow. We'd really appreciate that. Obviously, no pressure, but you know, if you would help us out, we'd appreciate it. So that's just kind of the housekeeping for what we're going for here. But today, what we want to do is, in the previous version of the live stream, one of the things that we really talked about was false positives, false negatives, and kind of the dichotomy there, right? So we wanted to dig into that a little bit more deeply and maybe continue the conversation. There's also been some conversation on Twitter today that I think is pretty interesting, and something that we wanted to really dig into. So I wanted to kind of give, for those that maybe didn't watch the live stream, an overview of what kind of how binary classification and false positives, false negatives actually work. Maybe use an analogy from real life that hopefully will kind of make it more concrete. And then we could talk about the relationship between false positives and false negatives, and maybe where this debate on Twitter is coming from, which is actually quite an interesting debate to get into. So there's this, basically in the world, we're trying to solve problems, and there's almost always some level of uncertainty that's involved in those problems, right? So one of the best examples, or kind of the most tangible examples, is the criminal justice system, right? The purpose of the criminal justice system is to identify those who have broken the law and, you know, have consequences, whether that's, I don't know if it's punishment or what exactly the overall goal of the criminal justice system is, but there's basically inflict consequences for breaking the rules is generally the idea. The problem is that the system itself doesn't, there's a level of uncertainty of whether or not the person that's being tried for the crime was actually the person who committed the crime, right? And so there's, that uncertainty creates an opportunity for error, right? And there's two types of, generally speaking, there's two types of errors, false positives, right? And in the criminal justice system, that would be a person who is wrongly convicted of a crime that they did not commit, and false negatives, which is a person who is wrongly acquitted, right? So let go of a crime that they did commit, right? Those are two types of error. There's obviously kind of correct decisions, which is you convict the person who did the crime and you acquit the person who didn't do the crime. But what we're really focused on is errors. And generally speaking, there's this concept that that is kind of a foundational element of the criminal justice system called Blackstone's formulation, at least the British and American criminal justice system. And the idea of Blackstone's formulation is this man, Blackstone, I don't know what his first name was, he stated, generally speaking, that it's better that 10 guilty people go free than one innocent person be convicted. And so this actually created a ratio or a relative value of different types of error. So just because false negatives and false positives are both types of error, that doesn't mean that they have the same weight in the context of the system that they're being applied to, right? So in the criminal justice system, Blackstone said false negatives are basically 10 times worse, or false positives are 10 times worse than false negatives, right? And then actually when the American system was being initiated, I suppose, Benjamin Franklin kind of doubled down on that. And Benjamin Franklin said, it's better that 100 guilty people go free than one innocent person be convicted. And so he established a 100-to-1 ratio between the cost or the weight of a false positive versus a false negative. Now, I just want to set that up. So the presuppositions basically are, there's two types of error in any problem where you're facing uncertainty and you have to classify something, right? There's two types of error, false positives and false negatives. Just because they're both types of error does not mean that they are equally costly, right? The type of error is equally costly. In the context of the criminal justice system, false positives are seen as being more costly than false negatives. But just to kind of show that that's not always the case, that's not always the relationship. In the medical system, you might say, like in medical diagnosis, let's say we're trying to diagnose tumors based on like a CT scan or something like that. You might say that it's better to have a false positive, which is we say that there's a tumor when there's not a tumor, than to have a false negative, which is when we say that you don't have a tumor when you actually do have a tumor, because it's better for us to, it's better for us to, you know, try to treat something that's not there than to ignore something that is there in the context of, you know, tumors and cancer and things like that. It's better to have like early diagnosis. And so it's not always that false positives are more costly than false negatives. It could be the opposite way around, but the idea is that there's a relationship to where they shouldn't always be treated equivalently. Maybe there are some scenarios where they would be, but in general, they often aren't. I don't know, Johnny, did you have anything you wanted to throw in there?
No, I was going to let you finish out because I go more about the conviction stuff and then I was going to add a lot. So,
okay. Yep. Okay. So maybe one of the things that's kind of important that we talked about was the funnel of fidelity in the live stream. And one of the big points of that is that we have a multi-phase process when it comes to detection and response as a whole. And the layers of the funnel are collection, which is how do I get telemetry that tells me what's happening within my environment, detection, which is how do I identify the telemetry that I believe is security relevant, triage, which is once we've alerted on certain activity, how do I quickly identify whether or not something is a false positive, false negative, false positive in that case. Investigation, which is I'm fairly certain that something is bad, but I'm going to really dig into it to see what's going on and maybe what the scope of it is. And then remediation, you need to clean it up. And the criminal, we kind of get that idea from the criminal justice system, actually, right? And so the criminal justice system has something called standards of evidence. And so the standard of evidence for conviction at court is beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's actually founded on that Blackstone formulation, right? It's beyond a reasonable doubt means that like it should mean that there's no question whether or not this person did it, right? And that helps us to limit false positives, right? However, if you apply that standard of evidence all the way down at the first encounter between a police officer and an individual on the street, it's going to be very difficult to meet that beyond a reasonable doubt standard. And so what they do is they have different standards like reasonable suspicion, probable cause, preponderance of evidence, and beyond a reasonable doubt. And so they're able to escalate that standard as it becomes more costly, basically, right? So like an interaction between a police officer and a person on the street that takes 10 minutes, that's relatively non-costly for both the state, like the police officer, and the individual. But convicting somebody of 20 years in prison is relatively very high cost to both the individual and to the state. And so the standards of evidence escalate as you get more and more costly to the system. Now, the same thing applies to the funnel where like it's relatively cheap to collect telemetry. It's relatively expensive to perform a full-on investigation of an incident, right? And so the standard of evidence for declaring an incident should be different than the standard of evidence for identifying an event that you want to collect and, you know, send to your SIM. So that's the general kind of framing of what this conversation is going to be, I think.
Yeah, I think, well, thanks for explaining that, Jared. I think one thing that first comes to my mind when it comes to the, like, the false positive, false negative and conviction topic is, in my head, not all, you know, attack techniques are created equal. In my head, they all don't hold the same level of severity as maybe another. So, like, we could break it down many different ways. And all, and obviously, it's going to be very subjective, right? So there is a privilege base. So, like, is this going to be privilege escalation, or is this going to be persistence at a system level, an administrative level, at a, you know, low privilege user level, et cetera? Is this just, you know, creating process and maybe doing defense evasion? Like, all those in my head hold different severities. And you have to, it's tough. And it's very, like, subjective on trying to identify what that is. The reason why I bring that up is, the same strategy that's taken with something, I'm trying to think of something very simplistic here, like maybe PowerShell encoding, in terms of detection strategy, which very, can be very precise, which ideally should have, you know, a low false positive rate, or even looking for like mimikatz.exe, the same strategy is often taken with a lot of behavioral-based things, so like detecting service creation. And because those two things are not created equal, I don't think we can follow the same strategy. And in turn, that's going to, like, to convict and identify whether or not that is malicious or benign, they're two different problems, and you have to take two different strategies to identify what those are. Like, you see someone loitering, for example, okay, caught red-handed. But if you suspect someone of murder, but you didn't catch them red-handed, now you have to follow a different strategy to kind of identify and get that conviction. And that's something that I think is, in my opinion, is often forgot within the industry, is there's the same strategy gets taken. And so regardless of across the board, when it comes to detection, they want to follow the same approach, or people might want to follow the same approach. And then it's limit false positive, limit false positive, limit false positive. And that we've seen how hurtful that can be for different organizations, just because, again, those attacks are not created equal, and some might hold more severity than others and could hurt the organization longer than others might. So approaching those differently is kind of like something I know we talk about a lot, Jared, and why we are kind of down that, you know, how do we, like, whenever we, like, look at detections, a lot of times we kind of try to find that base thing. I know we'll get into that here in a moment, but it's also one of those, the reasons is like, okay, we're accepting that there's going to be false positives in within that initial search, or within that initial advancement of trying to identify something. And we could lower it over time, or we could find a strategy, you know, like RBA, you know, we touched on that in the live. But whenever we want to do behavioral based things, we have to kind of approach it that way, because one of those things that we might think is a false positive could be a false negative, because someone could be blending in with an administrator and what administrative activities are.
Yep. Yeah. And I guess we could go ahead and get into the tweet. And
I didn't jump into that too early, did I?
No.
Okay, cool.
this is going to be a shorter episode, just because we don't have a guest, and also because we, all three of us, have a meeting we have to get to, and this was the only window that we could record. So it's probably going to be about an hour episode. So we want to kind of get moving along, I suppose. Now, one of the things that I think is important is we're going to show some tweets, and we're going to have some conversation about it. These are very nuanced, very important conversations for people to be having, and different people, different organizations, different individuals are going to have different perspectives on it. And that's going to be dependent upon their certain situation. So like a vendor is probably going to have a different opinion on something than like an organizational team member. And then certain organization, people that work for some organizations that have high investment in detection and response might have a different perspective than somebody who has a, like, belongs to an organization that has a low investment in detection and response. So we're not trying to say that anybody is wrong. We're just trying to, or that it's a bad idea or whatever. We're just trying to have a conversation and give our perspective on the topic. So we'll show the first tweet, which was by Samir, who works at Elastic. So Samir had this tweet, and he said, at the end of the day, detection is about reducing false positives to spot bad. Any evaluation that doesn't account for that, to me, is just scratching the surface and basically indirectly participates in alert fatigue or the increased in SOC analysis cost.
I do want to say one thing real quick before Jared. Yep. While we show these tweets, know that we're not attacking anything. Just because we have a different perspective, it doesn't mean we don't respect these people's views. Like, Samir is huge in the community and helps defense the defensive capabilities a lot. So we appreciate Samir, if you listen to this, we appreciate you a lot. But as we go through these things, just because we have a different perspective, it doesn't mean we're attacking anybody.
Yep. And so what I want to first point out is that I mentioned that false positives and false negatives are both types of error, right? And the best detection is the detection that maximally reduces error, right? So ideally, you want no false positives and no false negatives, but that's just honestly not possible in an uncertain world, right? When you're dealing with uncertain problems. And so the thing that really kind of caught my eye is the framing of false positive reduction as being the goal of detection, right? And what got interesting to me was this idea that, are we really trying to reduce false positives, or like why do we want to reduce false positives, right? And the way that I see it is, when you start off a detection program, all you have are false negatives, right? So all you have is the potential that an attack will happen in your environment and you don't know about it. That's all that exists, right? So, and you could consider those to be false negatives, you could say. And so when you create your detection program, you're creating your detection program to address those false negatives or the potential. It's generally speaking, false negatives are very infrequent, right? So like attacks in general are statistically infrequent. And so false negatives are also going to be infrequent. And so we're not really addressing false negatives in a direct sense. We're addressing the potential or the probability of a false negative occurring, right? But all that exists is the potential for false negatives. When you start building out your detection program, the necessary, in my opinion, the necessary output of that are false positives. So in my effort to reduce the probability of a false negative occurring, I necessarily will create false positives, or false, you could say in another way, false positives are the cost of reducing the probability of false negatives. Okay. And so the reason why I personally don't like the idea of reduction of false positives being the goal, or being presented as the goal of detection, is because the reason why we're worried about reducing false positives is, generally speaking, and he talks about this, right? So it indirectly participates in alert fatigue and SOC analysis costs, right? So the problem that it seems to me that people have with false positives, high false positives, is that it actually reduces the probability of the reduction of false negatives. So the more false positives you have, the more you're reducing the probability of that doesn't sound very good, but the higher your false positive rate, the less likely you are to actually be reducing false negatives, because you're going to be looking at a bunch of stuff. You're not using your resources efficiently. Okay. Now the problem that I see with that, and like, I'm not saying that this is Samir's problem, I'm just saying that this is a general problem in the industry, is that the effort, when people use false positive reduction as their kind of guiding light or North Star when they're building, when they're doing detection engineering, what tends to happen, in my experience and my observation, is they tend to lose sight of false negatives. And the problem is that, like I said, false negatives are statistically infrequent, right? So they don't happen very often. And so when you're doing your testing, it's not very likely that you're actually getting a good sample size of what the false negatives are. And so you could say, oh, well, like this detection still caught the example test that I ran. But the question isn't whether it catches the example test that you ran, it's whether it would catch anything performing the behavior that you're interested in. And as you reduce false positives, the likelihood is that you're going to also reduce false negatives, or increase false negatives, sorry. And that's going to defeat the purpose of the reduction of false positives.
Yeah, I think one thing along those lines as well to what Jared is talking about is whenever we look at the amount or the volume of false positives that we have to look at it from a per detection view, right? And then also understand, like, how often does this operation happen within the operating system normally, even if an attacker wasn't there per se, right? So what I mean by that is like service creation, for example. I'm not sure if anybody's ever like gone and looked at how often service creation happens within an organization, but it happens quite a lot. And so it's like, okay, well, if I know that I want to create a detection for service creation, is it a good approach to just like get a list or get a baseline of what my normal services are? Like, that'd be ideal, right? Like, if you could just pick and like, oh, I know these should be the services, and then like you might have some false positive still because you know, some things might pop up, or like a third party application and like the ending might be like created on the fly or whatever it is. I've seen that before, but like you're still going to have false positives there just because that happens a lot. And so it's like, well, how do you deal with those? Now, do we only look for, because then you have the opposite strategy. And so the opposite strategy that I see is very limited on what we're searching. So although we go to somebody and go to an organization, like I'm looking for a service creation, is it really service creation though? Or is it service creation under the presets that the name is XYZ, or that the image path involves ABC, right? Because if that's what your detection is looking for, okay, that's one strategy and that's totally fine. That might not be where you want to end, right? Because that can be easily evaded or bypassed. And we'll go over in a different episode where we talk about different bypasses and evasion. We're kind of updating that methodology and philosophy right now. But what I'm trying to get at is, if you build in a detection that's looking explicitly for some default way that, you know, Cobalt Strike creates a service and it's like a couple of letters or numbers, whatever it may be. Okay, that's fine. But you have to be explicit in what you're saying you're trying to detect, because now you're giving a false sense of security to your organization, to your team, and what you think. And then if something comes in and there is an actual breach and there was service creation involved, it's like, hey, I thought we were detecting service creation. It's like, well, one of my strategies was to look for X, and that maybe only got me 20% of all like potential service creation ideas, right? And so wanting to approach that strategy a different way is like, okay, well, if we want to open up that gate, false positives are going to fly through. And that's kind of what we talked about in the live, and maybe how to approach, you know, bringing in contextual value as it comes to image path and things like that, and identifying what a threshold is. And I don't know if we want to talk about that yet, Jared, but let's just kind of stick on this right now and then maybe talk about that.
Yeah.
But yeah. That's what I'm trying to get at is there are solutions to these strategies where there are false positives. I used to work for an MDR, for example, and they had a pretty good strategy. Like, yeah, they had like false positives as it came to certain strategies, but they were overlapping strategies in a way to say, okay, well, like, if false positives happen here, let's put it through the ringer for contextual value and contextual pieces, so that at least we have something to give to the SOC. So it's not like, hey, a service was created, because right now what we have, the 4697, it's like service was created and like here's the image path. It's like, okay, great. Okay, I don't know if that image path is good or bad. You know, it's like, I don't know any of that.
You can improve the efficiency with which triage occurs, right?
Yep.
By making a better detection.
Correct.
So like limiting false positives is one way to reduce the triage burden, right? But another way is to increase the efficiency of the triage for the results of that particular detection rule. And so like there's a bunch of different things we could do, and reducing false positives is only one way to do that. And that, like, I'm not saying that we shouldn't be looking to reduce false positives where we can. I'm just saying that making that your primary goal when building a detection is going to have side effects that are unintended, and which generally leads to an increase in false negatives.
Were you going on a train of thought there? Because I don't want to interrupt.
Yeah,
because
I was.
Go ahead, and I'll peel off a little bit. So go ahead.
Okay.
Sorry.
So yeah. So we have imagine that we have two detection rules, right? And they have the same efficacy in regard to false negatives. So like they're going to detect, they both detect the exact same thing. I know this is hypothetical, but let's just imagine that exists. If one of them can do that detection with only one false positive and the other can do that with 10 false positives, it's obvious which one you should choose, right? You should choose the one that has the least amount of false positives. The problem is that in reality, when we're comparing detection rules, if we're only looking at false positive rate, then like they don't actually have the same false negative rate, right? And so the question is what is that ratio, like the Blackstone formulation? Is it 100 to 1? Is it 10 to 1? Is it 2 to 1? Like, what is the ratio? And then how do you actually evaluate that? And like one of the things that I was trying to get at is, when I'm trying to figure out which type of error is worse, I personally think that in detection and response, false negatives are worse. And there's two reasons, right? The first reason is, like I said, the reason why people talk about reducing false positives is not intrinsic to false positives themselves. People don't care about false positives themselves. They care about false positives because false positives are going to create more false negatives. The more, like, if you're inundated with false positives, you're going to miss things that you should have been detecting, right? And so the cost of false positives is the potential for a false negative. The cost of a false negative is potential ruin for your company. And so, like, I've been really into this neuroscientist named Carl Friston. I think he's at King's College London, and he has this idea called the free energy principle. And one of the basic ideas is that any organism or any system that's making predictions wants to limit surprise as much as possible, because surprise is basically variability, and variability can be either positive or negative. But when it's negative, there's almost always a limit to how negative something could get. So for humans, like, if I were to make a choice to do something and I was surprised in a negative way, the end state could be death, which means that I don't get to continue on. If I'm surprised in a positive way, I win the lottery or something like that, the end state is I have a lot of money, but I keep playing the game, right? And so what you want to do is limit surprise, because then that allows you to continue playing the game. So, like, if we look at blackjack, for instance, I live in Las Vegas, so this is my example, but on any given hand of blackjack, you have a 42% chance of winning, right? Assuming that you're just kind of playing the book. But the casino is winning more than, 58% of the money. And the reason is that the casino sees blackjack not as an individual game, individual hand. They see it as a set of iterated hands, right? And the problem is that as you start to lose, there's a point at which you've lost it all and you don't get to play the next game, right? And so that means that, like, once you've lost, let's say you have $500, once you've lost your $500, you're out. You don't get to keep playing. The chances that the casino loses all their money is very, 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 very low, right? It's, like, basically impossible because they're extraordinarily wealthy, right? And so the chances are that you're going to fall out of the game before they fall out of the game. And the entire goal is to continue to play the game in as long as you possibly can. Now, when we think about business, the point of the business is to continue to exist and continue to operate for as long as it can. And a false positive doesn't, it has very little variability in what the cost can be. And so a false positive, the likelihood that a false positive is going to cause your business not to be able to continue to operate is very low. But the chance that a false negative, meaning that you've been breached and you don't know about it, is going to signal the end of your business is significantly higher than that of a false positive. Whether or not it's high just in and of itself, I don't know, but it's definitely significantly higher, or the cost to the business is significantly higher. And so that's probably the major reason why I think false negatives are more costly than false positives. And with that in mind, we should focus our detection engineering efforts on minimizing false negatives while also trying to think about how can we reduce the number of false positives that it takes to get the output that we're expecting.
The one thing that I've always thought about is, like, what is the analysis that's done to determine something is actually a false positive, and that, like, is worthy enough to limit and quote unquote tune a detection, for example. And I'm not saying this is a terrible strategy. I'm just saying there's probably a better process. The majority of that I've seen is, like, a volume count in the organization of how often, like, that service name or that binary was ran or whatever it is. And then it's like, once we've seen it over, like, 3-4 times, I've seen people just tune it out. And it's like, whoa, like, I think there's probably there needs to be more analysis there, right? Because, like, for example, like, one thing that I think of is it doesn't take much for an adversary to rewrite a binary in a legit path that they're running as admin, depending on what the security descriptor of that folder path and what that file is, and then, like, look for that. Right? Like, it doesn't take much. Like, I've seen that a lot with third-party applications. Like, I was recently on a vulnerability assessment. We did something very similar. And, like, we had the rights to that path, and we were able to rewrite what that file name was. And then we, like, just under the radar. And it was really easy. So doing a volume might not be the best route to determine, okay, this is a false positive. Let's move forward. Like, I've seen some things out there. Like, I believe I saw this in the Sigma project, and where it was, like, Kerberosing, for example, and then, like, removing Firefox as, like, talking over port 88. for like, that's the Kerberos protocol, is it talks to the domain controller. I don't know like if that should be the best strategy, because what if like someone just renames, like drops Ruby as, for example, renames it as Firefox and just runs it, right? For example, like maybe, for example, like let's see how many of those are talking to report 88 that are talking to a domain controller, or if the communication is incoming versus outcoming. Like trying to drill down into those specifics a little bit more, because like we don't want to inherently allow false negatives to move through because we believe it's a false positive. I think that's actually probably the most dangerous thing we can do, is to exclude something explicitly. And then like that was a false negative and it screwed us more than it helped us.
You just something to add on to what you just said. So you talked about let's say you observe some pattern, right? So you observe some event, let's say a service creation, you identify that service creation is benign, right? And therefore you shouldn't be alerting on it. It's a false positive. And then you choose to tune it, right?
Yep.
What do you use to tune it? Do you use the name? Do you use a combination of the service name and the path of the binary that's being executed? Do you use the service name, the path that the binary is being executed from, and the hash of the binary itself? What do you use? Because it's very difficult. It's very, very difficult for us to say these two services are so similar that they're going to behave in the same way. Because like, for instance, if you just use the name, the service name and the path, how do we know that that binary wasn't replaced with something completely different?
Yep. Yeah. I think like a rule, like I know one thing, like I've done compromise assessments with Luke, for example. And so Luke, correct me if I'm wrong here, but a rule of thumb for us, whenever we're doing like our hunting and looking, is like, if we are going to exclude something, we are going to exclude the path, the command line, the hash, and anything that is explicit to that, that we've said, okay, this isn't bad. So that way, if we see something out of the ordinary that with that, like the same image name, but a different hash, like, okay, like, was this just an updated version? Is this a 64-bit version, a 32-bit version? Let's look at the command. Let's dive into that even more, because the worst thing we can do is just do image name. Like I've seen that so many times where someone has done image name and star on both ends, or a path and a star on both ends, is like a wild character. And it's like, oh boy, you know what I mean? So it's like that whole thing is, you know,
but getting the hash in some cases, like services, getting the hash is not a simple process. Like you don't get that from the event that tells you that the service was created. And so like you actually potentially can't reliably reduce services without creating that blind spot, which that might be okay. Go ahead, Luke. I saw you unmuted.
No, I was just going to say that in compromise assessment, specifically prevalence is like a really quick way to get quick wins. It's not the end all be all, but a lot of the times it surfaces something. And a lot of compromise assessment tools will give you that hash information for stuff like services so that you don't have to go track it down yourself.
Yeah, and another thing too, like again, it goes back to like not all detections are created equal. So the process by which we go to convict whether or not it's malicious or benign are going to differ as well. Like Jared brought up a really good point. Like you can't just go grab a hash for a service, right? You might be able to go find, okay, like this service usually like correlates with this binary in this path, and then see if anything differs. And then like go inside your organization, like is the service really there, or is it only on this computer? Or does the image path differ? Like I see it on 50 different hosts and they're all coming from this one path, but this one differs slightly. That should be a causation of like, hey, I don't want to say that's a reason to convict. I don't know what the right word is off the top of my head, but that is a reason to be more suspicious and want to drill down even further. And so like, I'm real hesitant to convict all the time. So I also think,
can I pose something to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's the question, right? So what is the cost of falsely convicting an application of doing like, I guess we could think of it as when you convict in the context of detection, what you're doing is you're convicting an application of doing something malicious, I guess. Right.
Yep.
Is that fair? So what's the cost? What's the cost of convicting an application of doing something malicious?
That actually wasn't malicious.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't think it's much at all. Like, I think like it's significantly less. I think it's significantly lower than not convicting something that is malicious.
What's like, I know this is like, this could get completely out of control with all kinds of different contexts, but if you like, let's just say you saw a process was doing something that you thought was bad. What are you going to do to it? Like what would be the way to stop it from doing bad things? I'm not saying that this should be the strategy people take, but what is like the way to stop it from doing bad things?
You just stop the process.
You terminate the process, right? Yeah. And if it turns out that it wasn't bad, what happens?
You let it restart. It just goes on with
you. You let it restart. Obviously, there's some situations, like if it's LSAS and it's going to blue screen your box by killing it, then that's different. If it's on the domain controller, maybe that's different. But generally speaking, if you see a process that's or an application that's doing something that you think is malicious, the cost of taking action against that that application is very low, right? Yep. What's the cost of missing an application that actually is doing malicious things?
Potential financial ruin, data loss. Unlimited. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Ask Maersk, right? So Maersk is the big Danish shipping company. I think they lost like $1 billion or more from a breach. Yeah. It's unlimited, right? That's the reason why false negatives are worse than false positives in my estimate.
Yeah. One thing I'm curious, and I don't know if we could actually grab this data, and I know this isn't public, but I wonder how many breaches in the past 10 years have been like at least started, at least like progressed with identifying something as a false positive when it wasn't. So allowing it to progress further, or even like its initial stage, and being like,
impossible to give, but it would be interesting to look into. Like, how many breaches did we actually have an indicator for, and we didn't really look into it? Maybe I think that might go towards something like that you alerted on it, and then somebody in the triage phase marked it as a false positive. But that, like, to be fair to the people that are talking about false positive reduction, that's actually part of their argument, right? Is that by inundating people with alerts, you're going to cause them to potentially mark something that actually was detected in from the detection rule as being a false positive. Because they're basically, the more alerts you have a fixed capacity of alert processing capability, right? So you have a certain number of people, they work for a certain number of hours, and they can process a certain number of alerts per hour or something like that. So you could literally kind of figure out what your capacity is. And if you, let's say your capacity is, let's say you have 10 people for 8 hours and they could do 10 alerts per hour, right? You have 800 alerts that you could process, right? That doesn't mean you should be working people on the alert queue for 8 hours a day, every day, you know what I mean? But let's just hypothetically, you have 800 alerts that you could process. If you give them 900 alerts, there's two ways for them to deal with that, right? One way is they just ignore 100 of the alerts, and it's probably like maybe there's some prioritization, but generally it's like a first in, first out type thing, right? And that's bad, right? Because now they might be ignoring the most important alert, and there's no way for you to know. The second way is that they lower the scrutiny with which, or the amount of time with which they spend analyzing each alert, and that just increases the likelihood of bad decisions on an alert by alert basis. However, like, I think it's in most organizations' best interest to maximize the utilization of their alert processing capability, right? So if I have a capacity of 800 alerts per day, the way to maximize, like, obviously there's more efficient ways to use those 800 alerts, but I should be using those 800 alerts because that maximizes my reduction of false negatives. And that, like, and if you're not doing that, then you're leaving something on the table, basically.
Yeah. I think I forgot I was going on a train of thought there, and it kind of left. I know you're good. I think what you said was important, but still back to that thought too, is like, it's gone. The thought's completely gone. Rip.
But anyways, I can move on to the threshold thing if you want, or you could
go ahead with the threshold thing, because if it comes back up, I'll just interrupt you like you did me.
Yeah, no worries. Sorry, dude.
No, you're good.
Okay, Luke, can you share my screen again?
Yeah. You just got to go back to the views.
Oh, cool. Okay, neat. Okay, so this is something from, there's actually an academic discipline called signal detection theory. And this is a lot of times used in like medical testing. So like, what's the theory behind how we, COVID tests would be a good example, right? So there's uncertainty in whether or not somebody actually had COVID or not. And then you give them a test and it says yes or no. And then there's some amount of error on either side, depending on how they set it up, right? But here's this box, right? And so we have a signal, like we have two axes. We have a signal axis, which says that the signal, malicious activity, the signal for a tumor, the signal for COVID, whatever that is, it's in a literal sense, it either is there or it's not there. It's objective, right? And then we have our response from our detector, right? Which says this, it thinks that the signal is absent or it thinks that the signal is present. And then this is, they call this kind of like a confusion matrix, which basically says if the signal is present and the detector says that it's present, that's a hit, right? If the signal is absent and the detector says it's absent, that's a correct rejection, right? That's a true negative, right? But then you have the errors, right? When the signal is absent and you say it's present, that's a false alarm or a false positive. And then when the signal is present and the response is that it's absent, then it's a miss or a false negative, right? Now, here's where the whole thing becomes a problem, right? Because you can't have an error-free solution. It's in most cases impossible. Some situations with detection, the thing happens so infrequently that it probably is actually possible. But most of the things that attackers are doing are they're trying to do things that are kind of noisy in general so that they could blend in. So these graphs kind of show two things, right? So there's two curves, right? The first curve isn't colored in this situation. The second curve is half red, half green, basically, right? And what we see here is that there's the noise only curve. So that's just the natural state. If there was no signal, no tumor, if there was no malicious activity, that's the level of kind of static noise that is happening at any given time, right? And that's just information that's there. But then when you add the signal on top of it, right? So this is the curve for noise only. This is the curve for noise plus signal, right? And what you'll notice is that they overlap. And there's actually this variable called D prime, which basically indicates how much they overlap is the general idea. And so the thing is that this B, the beta is the threshold, right? And what you do when you're building a detection is you're constantly moving that threshold back and forth, trying to find the sweet spot. And as you, if you move, the threshold doesn't move, but let's imagine right where it's at, a percentage of the signal being present is going to be identified as malicious or correctly identified, but then the red indicates basically error, right? Those would be false negatives in this case, right? But if we were to move beta over here, we would have less false positives, right? The red section would become smaller. But we would also have less true positives. Or I guess, actually, sorry, if we moved the beta to the right, that's what would happen, right? So let's say we moved it to here and we eliminated all the possible false positives, right? Because we're now no longer alerting on noise, right? We would have no false positives, but we would lose this percentage, right? This percentage of the true positives, or they would become false negatives. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I think also one thing that's hard to grasp is like, okay, how do we take this and implement within our detection, you know, DNR process?
Yeah.
Right. And like we've seen a lot of different strategies for this, right? And again, this, I know I keep saying it and I sound like a dead horse probably, but it like the same thing we tell clients, same thing I just tell people is like it depends on the technique on where you want to go with this. Like, for example, something like I'm trying to detect Mimikatz.exe, you probably don't need to like sit here and try to deal with a threshold. Like you just simply look for hashes and binaries.
Yep.
However, if you want to look for different operations that Mimikatz performs, you have to approach it with this type of strategy. And it's going to take trial and error, and it's going to take testing. And testing is an interesting topic as well, which I'm sure Jared would like talk about. I hope we have 15 minutes left, so hopefully we can get into it. But like it's the, you know, I've said this on a previous podcast, but I'll say it again. Like there was this show I watched and it was like there's something about like hunters or something like that. There's two FBI agents that used to study like serial killers. Headhunter, is that what it's called?
Mindhunter.
Mindhunter. Did you watch it yet, by the way?
No, you just told us about it and I remembered.
No, okay, cool. Anyways, Mindhunter. And anyways, in there they talk about like the only thing that we know about murderers or serial killers are like things that they told us. That's the same thing as it pertains to like detection engineering, honestly, when it comes to attacks. Like things that we know are the things that we caught, we've perceived that we've caught. That's a big one. Potential research and things that other people have told us. But there's a big gap there, and it's called the unknown that we don't know. So it's like, okay, now we have to break things out into different operations and trying to talk about and figure out a way to detect things at a lower level. And again, that's going to take false positives to stream in order us to like
figure out the proper threshold by what you want to do. But a good operation, for example, is what's a good one? I don't want to use service creation again. You know,
access token theft.
Access token theft, for example. Like, we can go through a lot of different operations, and a lot of them are not like, well, I won't get into that. It's Jared's thing. It's they're not needed in order for it to happen. So the question is, what happens when it comes to data, right? When we're trying to look for a way to detect it. And like, impersonation is a thing that happens on the operating system all the time. So like, again, there's not a lot of data out there right now in order to do impersonation well, and or to see impersonation activity well. But the point I'm trying to get at is you have to perform proper testing. So how do we do that? Okay, so you have a lot of tools out there, right? I'm trying to think of like, what's, you mentioned one the other day, Jared, that was like the staple for token impersonation when it first came out. I know there's Git System.
Incognito. Let's
okay.
Just say.
Yep. Yeah, yeah. So that one, Git System and Meterpreter and things like that, right? And there's different variations of token impersonation, right? So you have regular token impersonation, you have name pipe impersonation, you have RPC impersonation. Like, you have a lot of different types of impersonation. And then it breaks down between like setting one up in the primary, as the primary token or as an impersonation token, which goes to like different things. So right, there's different things that can be broken out here. And so we have to scope it correctly. But then once we scope it and we think we have a good strategy and we've created our detections, we have to make sure that we're able to figure out what is our gap here. And so what are we able to detect? And a lot of times we hear like the 50, 60, 70, 80%. We have that much coverage. Well, it's like, do you really though? Because if you really want to see whether or not your detection is allowing false negatives in, then test things at the operational level and see if it triggers your detection. And that's how you'll be able to do that. But you can't do that without breaking down things or deconstructing it properly and spreading out what the operations are and then finding the different variations. And that's going to take work, right? Like, there's been times Jared and I have tossed back, like, do we think this function could be used to do X? And it's like, I don't know. Let's code it up and figure it out. And so like going back and forth, okay, like for example, and then like going and finding telemetry for that. Okay, like, you know, Jared came with something for me the other day, right? And he was like, our EDR is really like looking at this one thing. And I'm like, I don't think so, but I have a little side project I'm working on. Let me code it up and see if I can get it. And I got it, right? So it's like those type of communications, those type of diving in needs to happen. But anyways, yeah, I saw you said, yeah, Jared, to me saying like, if you really want to see if you're allowing false negative in, test at the operational level. So I figured you had something to say on that, but I wanted to.
Yeah. Okay. So I'm just going back to this graph real quick, because I think it's germane to what Johnny's talking about. One of the things that like the criticism of me presenting this graph, I imagine is going to be like, well, I don't know how to quantify the noise curve and the signal curve. And I don't know how to quantify like where my threshold is. Like it, I don't know how to like put a number to that. But like what I'm really trying to get across is like, it's important for you to understand that this is how it works, even if you can't put numbers to it, right? So as you move the threshold, right? If you move the threshold to reduce false positives, then you're going to be introducing false negatives. That's how it works, right? It's, and like some moving of the threshold is going to introduce less false negatives, less opportunity or probability of false negatives, but it's almost always going to make some change. So you can't decouple the two things. Now, going to what Johnny's talking about, an important thing is that for any behavior that an attacker might use, so an attack technique, right? So access token manipulation, Johnny said, hey, it's possible for me to just steal a token directly from an existing application. I can impersonate a name pipe client. I can impersonate an RPC client, and I could use that to gain access to a different processes to a different access token, right? Now, what we're really kind of talking about, I think, is useful to talk about along the perspective of a spectrum. So here we have the visible light spectrum. Actually, we have the electromagnetic spectrum, which is this guy up here, and that has things like cosmic rays and gamma rays, ultraviolet light, microwaves, radar. And imagine that each of those is a different technique, right? But then there's one technique, which is represented by the visible light spectrum, which is a subsection of the overall electromagnetic spectrum. And let's say that's access token theft, right? Token impersonation. Okay. Now, again, it's very hard for us to be able to, and we have some strategies on this, but we don't have time to get into it on this episode. But It's very difficult for us to quantify which variation of an attack is should be in the violet set portion of the range and which version of the attack should be in the green portion of the range and which version of the attack should be in the red portion of the range. The key is that if you're trying to test or validate a detection rule, you don't want to test it with only violet versions of the attack, right? And so the idea here is that as we're trying to test things, we want to, in a dynamic fashion especially, we want to present that detection rule, for instance, with a wide variety, with a what we would say is like a maximally differentiated set, representative sample set of the different variations, right? And so instead of presenting it with three different versions of direct token impersonation where we just steal a token from an existing process, why don't we present it with the RPC way, the name pipe way, and the direct access token theft way? And if we have a detection that could detect all of those, then that would be a more resilient or more robust detection than something that could only detect one or the other, is generally the idea behind how we test. Johnny?
Yeah, I think, man, it's hard not to go into that. We only have 9 minutes left. Yeah, this was a lot of back and forth too. I don't even know if like to the extent that we have it 100% correct either when it comes to testing yet. Like we play, like we've talked about this. Jared and I did a talk at DEF CON where we talked about like there are different types of testing you want to do. So it's like whether or not whatever your telemetry source is, whether that's an EDR, native, whatever, is actually collecting the appropriate telemetry in order for you to be successful in a detection, right? So that's one type of testing. Then we have another where it's like, okay, let's test out detections and what's really being done. And we've gone really back and forth and we've tried a lot of different avenues. And we think we have a pretty good idea. The one thing that sticks and works and we've seen work takes a lot of legwork in deconstructing what Jared's talking about is like those different operations. Now, one thing you find, which is quite nice, is a lot of those operations tend to be mirrored across techniques. So if you see those around cross, like for example, like process access, the reason why process access, like it's used a lot for like, you know, like helping to see like injection and like dumping credentials and things like that. The issue is like anytime you want to access any process whatsoever, you have to open a handle. And so it's like, it's really hard to determine whether or not that action leads to or led to dumping credentials or led to. Like we've tried, right? Like we've looked at access rights. We've tried I've done like a lot of like Jupyter notebooks when it comes to that. I've done detections around things like that. We've tried, but the reality is like, even though that action happened, it doesn't mean necessarily like the other thing led. So what we've done when it comes to testing is try to really find what that core behavior is that the technique is made of. So once this technique, once this action happens, once this operation happens, the technique is over. It was successful and we can move on. And that's what we try to get to eventually. I know
let's just talk about it real quick because we got 7 minutes. So, okay. So just to set the foundation, the Mimikatz style of credential dumping from LSS, we'll just focus on that one example for now, has kind of a sequence of three operations that it does. It first must enumerate processes because you have to have the process identifier of LSAS, and the way that you get that is you have to enumerate all processes, look for a process named LSAS, and then get the PID. There's actually a really cool blog post. I forget who wrote it, so I feel bad right now, but maybe we'll put it in the description that talks about multiple different ways to get the PID of LSAS, which would violate what I'm explaining, but it's too much to talk about in the short time we have. So first you have to get the PID of LSAS. Then you have to open a handle to LSAS, specifically a read handle. And then you have to actually read the contents of LSAS where the credentials happen to be stored, right? Now, what Johnny's getting into is each of those things are operations. So we call it process enumerate, which is enumerating the processes. Process open, I prefer open, but a lot of people will refer to it as process access. The reason I prefer open is because you close the handle afterwards and open and close are symmetrical. Process enumerate, process open, process read, right? And the key is that each of those operations, those are the things that we actually observe using our EDR, right? So think about it this way. We have process creation events. We have registry key read events. We have file create events. We have process access or process open events. We see the world, the cyber world, in the context of operations. And so if we think about attack techniques in the context of operations, we've now aligned our mental model for how we think about the attack and our perceptual model, which is how we actually see things in the environment together, right? And so that means that, but we only see one operation at a time, right? And so we have to choose as a foundation for our detection rule, one of the three operations: process enumerate, process access, process open, or process read. And the key is that it is possible to open a read handle to a process and never use that read handle to actually perform the read operation, right? Because, for instance, tons of processes will open an all access handle because they, like, you intend to do some random thing like write to a process memory, but you just ask for all access, which includes the read operation, and now that you never use it to read. And that differential, so anytime a handle is open to LSAS where with the read access write, but it doesn't actually use that handle to read, those are false positives, assuming that you're using the process open or process access operation as your foundation. What's better, right? What's better is to say, let's just go look for the process read operation, which is where we're reading the memory, because that we can infer from the process read that the process open happened because it's a requirement, right? And by doing that inference, we're eliminating those false positives and we're able to maximize the information that we're getting from that. The problem is that a lot of EDR don't give us telemetry on process reads, like Johnny was mentioning. And so as a result of that, we end up being forced to use a less less ideal operation as our foundation. And that's an accepted risk, right? That's a blind spot that we have that we just have to deal with. So that's maybe the summary. I don't know if you have more.
Yeah, and we'll link to Jared's and I's workshop. I think it's on YouTube that we give at DEF CON. But the reason why I see a lot of people not using process access, for example, is, again, the false positive and false negative conversation. And I wanted to round back off to that. It's like, I think a lot of the times we have to understand, I think there's a couple things. One is we have to understand the thing that we're looking for. Does it happen a lot in the environment? Regardless, is it a normal like the reality? Noise. Is it like something the operating system just does, right? Okay, and we have to accept at that point that with whatever way we look at it, there's going to be false positives. Then we have to identify what's the threshold of false positive that we're willing to like deal with, because that's going to inherently determine the threshold of false not negatives that we deal with it, or that we're willing to deal with as well. And that we're willing to miss. And that's a key piece, is if you're willing to tune out false positives, you are willing to tune out false negatives.
Tune
in. And that has to be a risk that either you accept or because it's one of those things, like once you do it, like you can't just say, oh, I didn't know. Well, it's like, well, there's a reason why people tune, you know? So, and then three, once we move forward, we have to identify, okay, this is the threshold by which I'm willing to deal with when it comes to false positive, false negatives. Then, and this is another, we'll talk about this in the future. I might even do a blog on like different detection strategies, whether they're precise, whether they're not, it'll kind of go with like the detection spectrum kind of blog that came out 2 or 3 years ago. But it's like, that's something we have to talk about as well, is whether or not like what strategy we're going to take is going to be precise, is going to be a little bit broader, because we're going to have to fit whatever we've determined that false positive rate's going to be.
Yep. And as you're tuning, how do we minimize the impact? Like, there are better ways to tune than others. Like we said, are you tuning based off the service name only, or are you tuning based off a combination of features of different bits of information, basically, to build a more unique signature for the service that you're trying to tune out?
Yeah. And you have to let, just like in the justice system, just like in, you know, hospitalization, like, would you trust a nurse to do a doctor's job? No. Then why are you trusting detection to do triage's job? Like, allow the different pieces within the funnel to do their job effectively so that you can be more efficient. Those things can go hand in hand. Yeah. But whenever you start to tune just explicitly only in detection, you kind of take the resources away from triage so it can't be effective nor efficient.
You should tune your detections just like you should tune in to DCP Live on all of these social media platforms.
Oh, man. Wow.
Every other Monday.
Look at that. Luke's been waiting to use the banner feature for like a day because we just found this platform a day ago. But he's
look at these beautiful links, though. They're all through our website. They all forward to the correct location.
Dude, that's cool. Awesome. Good job, Luke. And yeah, and I mean, I don't have anything to top that, to be honest. So with that, we just hit an hour. Hopefully you enjoyed this conversation. Hopefully it's something we could continue. Like I said, we're giving our opinions on the topic. We're happy to be criticized. We're happy to have conversation about it. And hopefully through that conversation, we're able to reach a more robust understanding of how this all works, because it is a hard problem. We are dealing with uncertainty, and we're trying to minimize the amount of uncertainty that we actually face on a daily basis and maximize the value that we're providing to our organizations.
And this isn't just a shameless plug. The best way to have that conversation, if you watch this episode, you feel strongly about something, you disagree with it, join the next live session, drop a comment, and we can argue about it all you want. And that's what that's for, is to have that back and forth that we're not able to do when we just put our opinions out in these episodes. So
boom.
Come fight us.
Oh, boy. All right, everybody. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks for supporting the DCP podcast in 2023. Hopefully, we're going to be more consistent with things. We're going to provide more content, and yeah. So,
lastly, before anybody roasts me, I am moving. That's why there's literally nothing behind me. There's one person in a YouTube video once that roasted me in the comment section for not having anything up in my back wall. I'm moving in like 3 days, so please don't come after me. But besides that,
still not going to.
Hope everybody has.
In his office.
I hope everybody has a good week.
All right. Cheers, everyone. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Detection Challenging Paradigms. If you want to keep up with us, you can do so on Twitter at DCP the Podcast, or on our website, dcppodcast.com, where you'll find links to all previous episodes and their episode guides, as well as to our store, where 100% of our proceeds benefit charity. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.